Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. This show is for the week of October 5th, 2022. The global carbon dioxide levels are 415.16 parts per million. Compare that to the required 350 parts per million. And there are only 2,645 days left until the year 2030. Time to get cracking. Anyway, the Boston Globe reported that the electricity rates in the state of Massachusetts are going to go up this winter. Big question is, how should people, particular climate activists, think about that? Because we're all climate activists nowadays, but how should you think about this rate increase that's been proposed by the various electricity providers? In order to talk about it, I caught up with Steve Sherlock at Franklin Matters, and we went through some of the background on it. Of course, some of the discussion pertains to my hometown, but I think that the issues involved are generally applicable, and everyone's going to encounter them sooner or later, so good to hear someone else's example. A vision, right, where you have good housing close to some sort of convenient transportation and facilities that don't require you to jump in your car and drive 2 miles to get to a big parking lot.
Steve Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet at WFPR.FM, and in the local area, Franklin, Mass, FM dial at 102.9. Here for another session of Making Sense of Climate, my guide, our local Franklin resident expert, Ted McIntyre. Ted, how are you doing this day?
Great, Steve. Great to be here. Yes, it's wonderful. A beautiful fall day outside.
Yes. And yet the challenges are all around us, especially on the climate front, hey?
Yeah. There's tons and tons and tons of stuff going on. I think a interesting place to begin is in everybody's wallet or pocketbook, right?
Here in Franklin
in Massachusetts, and their pocketbooks and how it relates to the roadmap and all kinds of interesting connections about stuff. So let me try and set it up. And
absolutely,
we can talk it through. Okay, where to begin? Last spring, our friend Mr. Putin decided to invade Ukraine, right? And subsequently, everyone's followed the ups and downs of the Ukrainian thing. In fact, you may know that, I guess recently, two explosions blew up what is called the Nord Stream gas pipeline that crosses the Baltic Ocean from Russia into Germany, right? And so one of the things is that Russia has been providing Germany with natural gas, generally methane. Let's stick with methane to run their economy. And now Europe is under stress for having enough methane gas to run everything through this coming winter, right? It's cooler out here, and even in Franklin. The other thing is that methane gas is a global commodity, right? It goes around on ships. There's like 99.5% of what is produced is already used, already committed, right? So there's no room, there's no elasticity, there's no extra
space. Very little elasticity, absolutely, right? Yeah.
It's a great word if you don't know any economics, right? But I mean, it's like this, everything's being used. What has happened is the following. Here in Massachusetts, there were two major providers of electricity, okay? So now I switch from methane to electricity. Two major providers of electricity here in the Franklin area. I'm going to make sure it's National Grid gives us our electricity.
Okay? Right.
Up north of Boston, it's Eversource, but down this part, of, generally speaking, down here, National Grid. In Massachusetts, every 6 months, the people who provide you the electricity have to forecast a cost for that electricity, what they want to charge people for the next 6 months.
Yep.
Well, because for the last 20 years, New England has moved from oil to make electricity to cheap, relatively cheap methane from Pennsylvania, right? All of our, most of our electricity, 58% of our electricity is generated from natural gas.
Right.
Mr. Putin has screwed everything up, right? The price of that natural, of that methane gas to make electricity is going up, 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 up. As a consequence, National Grid has projected effectively a doubling of price of electricity starting November 1st. And quite likely, the people north of Boston who are on a two-month delay schedule, sometime in November, they will also propose a dramatic increase in the price of electricity, which, of course, goes right to everyone's soft spot, right?
Sure.
All of a sudden, you're writing a bigger bill for your electricity, which then causes pain and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Don't like it. And certainly people who are on a fixed income, right? They get hit hard. So that's in the works, and it begs discussion because it, of course, is a climate issue, right? Burning methane to make electricity is the biggest climate issue. And it raises a whole raft of other issues about how do we put prices on these things, you know, different areas. What are we doing to get out of this jam? Let me just say, you know, this is not a suspense novel. I mean, if, and I'm not ruining something that we should have done, but clearly this is added evidence that the wind and the sun come for free. Mr. Putin cannot turn that spigot on and off. If we were powered by wind and solar plus battery storage, yada, 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 we would be in a much more stable place. The price wouldn't vary.
Right? Mm-hmm.
And again, just saying people should look at this circumstance where the industry can double the electricity rate, that double the cost of electricity on a moment's notice because of this, and say, wait a minute, how come National Grid has such power and authority and can do these things, right? Because they're just, they ultimately are making money about on this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, a whole bunch of questions come up. And of course, all of this drains back down because here in Franklin, we are in the National Grid territory, right?
Yep.
And what we, I guess what I think people need to know is at least to have a way to think about what's happening and put it into a context that's bigger than I'm getting screwed again. Right. I'm bad things. I got to pay more money. Right. You begin to learn about what are the influences, what could be done differently. And I hope people become more sympathetic to the things that have to be done differently. That is to say, back to wind, solar, green electricity, reform of how we distribute that electricity, all these things. So it's a very interesting circumstance.
Absolutely.
So does that make sense? I mean, is that a reasonable explanation of where we are today?
Yeah, and even for those specifically in Franklin who are already part of the municipal aggregation deal that the town established in 2020, while we dodged the bullet, so to speak, because that price increase does not affect us, future price increases, and our current contract per conversation with Jamie Helen is good through, I think it's October, November of 2023. And what the price is going to be after that clearly will possibly go up. But I would hope that it would still be less than other relative prices out there, given the way we're doing our municipal agreement. That's the whole concept. We're buying in bulk,
right,
on behalf of the town. So, to a quick reminder for the residents, clearly anybody in 2020 when municipal aggregation came in, you needed to opt out. And ideally, there were at least two cases that I know of. Those who already had solar or a solar contract, obviously you didn't need it. That was okay. And those who already had a contract, whether solar or not, that they couldn't get out of, then you can't make a deal at that time. But the other interesting piece is Franklin's a dynamic community as well. Now we're further along from 2020, new people coming into Franklin. Are they automatically part of the municipal aggregation, or do they need to do something specifically? So to the extent that now is a good time, the rates will be coming up in November. And even Jamie said, even if the state, a la Attorney General, doesn't give them all that they've requested, certainly it's going to be more than what they got currently, right, which is still more than what we're paying through the municipal aggregation. So,
and just just a reminder, the municipal aggregation is this technique where a town like Franklin can basically make the bulk purchase agreements of the electricity proper, right? In other words, it's interesting. I mean, that the bill that you're paying for includes the generation of electricity and the transmission of electricity. And yeah, so the town can go out and buy the electricity from whoever they want, have it routed in. And that's and the aggregation of the town allows you to buy in bulk. So you get a good deal. And if you're smart about it, you can also make that electricity green, which Franklin has done. We can talk about a little bit more about that, but Franklin's getting cheap green electricity now to the wisdom of the people who brought us community aggregation. And and so that's what community aggregation means. And what I think you're saying is that people have moved in lately. How do I say this?
Or more recently.
The nudge in, right, is a topic I've heard discussed in climate circles as because most people are just on inertial guidance. They don't want to think about stuff, right?
Right.
It's like when you take a new job, right? You have to actively go out and sign up for the IRA, your 401k, right?
Sure.
You have to actively choose that. And most people, if you're 22, you say, forget it. I'm not going to retire for a while. Mm-hmm. What's different, what you could do is you could say the default is to be included in the 401k. And then it's happening, you don't have to think about it, right? It's a societal choice. Here in Franklin, the nudge in, you defaulted into the program, right? Which is at the conversion date, right? But you were automatically in. And now people come in afterwards probably have to be more active, right?
Correct.
Making sure they've got this opportunity.
Yeah. And people can always check, because I think, and you mentioned it as well, our electric bill and most energy bills, although I only have electric, it breaks out the costs in two factors. So you got the supply cost and you got the distribution cost. So the supply line, which is the second part of the bill, reflects our 10.7 cents kilowatt hour via Dyne Energy, I think is the company name, and it's wind power. Versus the distribution cost, which is the top part of the bill, at least from National Grid. And that outlines all the, getting the electricity from whatever transformers through to
all the wires plugs. And poles and
all
stuff.
The plugs in the house. Right. People can check. We'll include links in the show notes as well for the municipal aggregation page on the town page, which has information. So that for those who came in after, you can certainly find out all the info as to what municipal aggregation does. With Jamie in the conversation, it came up because some people, would rather go to Costco or BJ's to buy on the bulk. I said, well, yeah, that's a good thing. But remember that when you go to Costco and BJ's, you're already getting the cost benefit because you have paid for the membership. You don't have to pay for the membership in municipal aggregation. You just have to be a Franklin resident.
Right.
And it's free to get aggregation with the two caveats. If you've already got a solar thing on your house or you got a deal that gives you something with a contract you can't get out of, then obviously under those circumstances, you don't get it. But for anybody else.
So from a climate perspective, the climate hawk perspective, the question becomes what to think about a doubling of your electricity rate in the context of everything that's going on. Okay. And from my perspective, what is driving the doubling of the rate is fluctuations in the price of the methane that's being used to generate the electricity. Supply and demand, right? And that
basic economic change, principle.
Well, there's two things that drive the prices for electricity. And the methane is the availability of the methane, which, of course, as I said, Putin has cut down, and the pipelines that bring the methane into the state of Massachusetts. Because remember, there's no fracking wells in Massachusetts. We are fortunate enough or unfortunate enough not to have anything like that here. So mm-hmm. we have to bring everything in.
Right.
And the variabilities are, and this is, so this is where the gas industry that is driving all this is what they're going to talk about. With how we need more pipelines in order to protect ourselves from these variations, right? And you just, if you heat your home with gas, that's likely to go up too, right? Because mm-hmm. the gas is, there's competition for the methane to make electricity and to heat your home. And the dependence of the grid on methane, which to my mind is caused by the profit motive of the utilities, right? They like to sell you gas, right? Mm-hmm. And there's an old saying about it: when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right?
Right.
I mean, they want to use gas to solve everything, whereas the Massachusetts roadmap is calling for increased amounts of renewable electricity. And the virtue of the renewable solar and wind, yes, in particular.
Yeah.
And as we keep saying over and over again, those things are, once you've bought the wind turbine, the wind comes for free.
Right.
So all you have is a mortgage, absolutely stable prices, right? And that's the direction that we should be headed. And my concern is that we're going to see a lot of screaming and rending of vests over the next 6 months from the gas industry that wants more pipelines and try and scare people cold in the dark.
Yeah, and we've talked about that with the ISO New England and their development of the plan and excluding. And at one point, I believe we discussed where they didn't allow wind power because it was too cheap to come into our supply stream based upon the rules that they had already set up. And it was like, okay, well, change the rules, guys. I mean, you know, but got the financial incentives, which we've covered in prior episodes, so we don't need to dwell on it here, but they do have the incentives currently to continue to foster that as opposed to making the changes.
Right. But I guess what I'm submitting is that when you see this screaming headline in the paper, mm-hmm. right, that will scare you because all your prices are going to go up. It's not because we're looking at renewables, it's because of the construction and the functioning of our existing grid, which is something that we can change,
right?
Talk about change instead of climate change.
And I think there was another article related to this where some of the media have started looking at, okay, so Mass Electric, National Grid, Eversource, et cetera, started saying, so what are the other states doing similarly? And while they're all going up, they're all up on different schedules and by different amounts. And we actually have a grid that is interconnected. So it also begs the question, well, who controls that? Well, it goes back to ISO New England, which actually manages that. But it also revealed to me in terms of a podcast that I listened to that one of the other items in this side deal, which we've mentioned with the Manchin piece, FERC would get, and Federal Energy Resource
Regulatory Commission
would actually get part of their scope would be that level of interstate commerce would be part of their regulation, which had not been up until this passage, assuming it passes at some point, right. Which I found interesting. And I know we can dwell on it for a couple of reasons here.
Right. No, I mean, that the whole, what it brings up are questions about what is the structure of the grid? How are the costs allocated? Is it fair? It does seem strange that, you know, if you're driving down I-95 and you go from Massachusetts into Rhode Island, all of a sudden the cost of electricity changes, even though all the wires just go back and forth and it's one integrated system, right? Is that good, bad? I mean, why are those things? I can't say, but it certainly is a worthwhile discussion. And the idea that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, would begin to look at these issues of transmissions, even between regions, I think is what, so ISO New England, right? So there's ISO New England, then there's ISO New York, which is big enough to be its own sort of entity, right?
Sure. Yeah.
How do we trade power back and forth between those? And if there was a transmission line that crossed that from New York into Massachusetts, you know, who owns that? Mm-hmm. And what I read, because I read somewhere how there's a lot of these transmission lines that are in queue now to bring power from one place to the other. And this
sure.
rewinds back to the mentioned permitting thing. But a lot of them are held up because the companies can't figure out who's going to pay for it.
Yeah.
Right? It's this thing where there's a lot of financial entities involved, mm-hmm. right? All of them don't want to leave money on the table or get,
right.
you know, pay too much. And so that slows things down while they debate about stuff.
Right.
And at some level, you can say, gee, the federal government should step in and say, by jingo, you know, none of this, you guys don't get to argue about the profit motive anymore. We need to build this. The federal government's going to own it. We'll talk to you later.
Right.
I mean, that's somewhat utopian, but you can cut the Gordian knot by being more planning.
Well, in a sense, making sense place. The term, I believe, is somewhat used, is some, not somewhat, is used as, you know, according to the benefit received, right? So it's the benefit payer. So if you have, as an example, we're making it up for this conversation, you've got a line crossing two states. Well, which state is going to benefit? So if there's a 60-40 relationship, then the beneficiaries should pay on a 60-40 rate, as opposed to your point, continuing to just go back and forth. No, I want you to pay 70. I'm only going to pay 20. Da, 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 da. What's the benefit to the both parties or multiple parties? And then assign the benefit in the proportion thereof.
Right.
That at least is something that has already been working in different places and would now be applied to this. So to me, that sounds good. I'm sure there's a different story to that from somebody's, but that's okay.
Yeah, I think this is, from my perspective, I regard this as progress in terms of the discussion that we have to have. It's less about the global warming exists, and now we're into questions about what are the concrete things that we can do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're recognizing that, we've talked about this stuff in the past, but sort of national planning of how we're going to get electricity from one place to another is required. And I think there's some movement of that in the Inflation Reduction Act, where FERC begins to think about a national plan, but that stuff needs to be strengthened. And it is something just to be aware of, that this is in the zeitgeist out there. I mean, how do we do these national things?
Yeah. Yeah. And we had touched on that prior, especially in regards to the main transmission coming down, bringing the water power from Quebec in through to Mass. So assuming that does happen and our wind power develops, then that theoretically can give us more. But the work still is required to be done either way.
Oh, yeah.
And going back to that other podcast that I mentioned, Ezra Klein, who's a noted New York Times journalist, has a regular podcast, and he caught up with Jesse Jenkins, who's from Princeton, Net Zero Group. He's done a couple of projects there. They went for, I think it was an hour and 45 minutes. It's a long one. It's far longer than we've done.
Well, and Jesse Jenkins and people at Princeton, so it's a, you know, academic exercise, but they are planning, looking to see what does it take to build this. Now, this is sort of an academic exercise of planning the grid.
Mm-hmm.
Where would the power lines have to go? How many solar panels do you really truly need? Can you really do it? And they keep coming to this conclusion that it's entirely possible for us to do it if we have our head in the right place. And
right.
That's the net, but that's the academic side of the study to say, you know, what does it take to get us mm-hmm. down the road, right?
Right. Oh, absolutely. Because even going back to whether it's reduction plan or our own local climate plan, just because it's been signed doesn't necessarily mean the things will happen. People still have to make that work. And that is a lot of work still for things to happen by 2030, which is not that far away, right? So, you know,
tell me, You started to make reference to the Jesse Jenkins podcast and articles, and what were the? I think you were headed for the disclaimers they were putting in front of their.
Yeah, I was going to come to the disclaimers later, but just in terms of the things that struck me is how much work is that still to be done before we get to 2030? All right, you know, new pipelines, new transmission lines, et cetera. So he quotes, and I'll paraphrase the quote. The electric grid, where we are today, it took 140 years to get there. We need to double the electric grid. And oh, by the way, double it before 2030. That's a lot of work. And then there was certainly discussion about the footprint of the wind farms. And we've seen them along the sands, I mean, along the lands, et cetera. And now they're certainly going to be proposed offshore. The wind farms that required for the U.S., the most effective, most cost-effective of our net zero scenarios spans an area that's equal to Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee put together. And the solar farms are from an area the size of Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Mass. It's like, whoa, there's a lot there.
Are they saying that the Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, that land area needs to be tied up in solar panels?
Solar panels to power the U.S. and the spread of, excuse me, wind power, wind turbines, and the area of those three states would be the wind power itself. But the wind power, because you can't put the towers next to each other, you've got to spread them out. That would be over that other list of states. So Illinois, Indiana, right. Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee put together. There's a lot of space. Now, it's an academic exercise. Are all their I's dotted and T's crossed appropriately? That's where other academics are going to, and other scientists, I'm sure, are going to go through and say, oh, that number's wrong, this number's right. But the whole point of it is simply, it's a staggering amount of work. And it needs to start today.
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen it said that you know, you don't need, there's so much work to, so much clean energy that we need to generate. It's like, just start building. Don't worry about 2050. Don't worry about anything. Right. Just build as much as you can, as fast as you can, and you won't be able to keep up. Right.
That's And they do say it is possible. The required additions in the on the solar capacity is effectively 38 to 67 gigawatts of solar power a year. So you average it out, you know, it's like going to be 25 gigawatts per year. We have achieved 25 gigawatts in a year. So it is possible. But obviously, then it gets required that political will, the environmental will, the people, the companies, is certainly not going to happen because somebody passed a bill and snaps their fingers. There's a whole lot of work that has to make that happen.
Meaning there's room for everyone listening or who cares to put their, it's like, you don't have to join the, you don't have to be a wind turbine repair guy, right? You just have to be politically supportive and favor these policies that will do the right thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But I mean, And we've touched on it before. I mean, like the economic growth opportunity, the jobs that are available that aren't going to go to China, right, are huge in all of this.
So. All the installation, all the maintenance, all the conversions, because once, I mean, we're talking creation of the power, whether wind or solar, but then there's aspects, and we've touched in other episodes where, well, that still has to get to the residential buildings, and then conversion to heat pumps or whatever, has to get into the office buildings and convert them. There's an awful lot of work that needs to be done, and there's going to be opportunity for those. And we talked with Jeff Roy, and we'll have him back again at some point. Part of the deal, at least from a Mass level, was to incent and create funds for the training and the all that kind of stuff, so that could happen. So it's possible. It's just got to start.
So I'm back to the question of what is the thing that's preventing forward progress? What gets in our way? I would volunteer that the things that are currently in our way are entrenched interests.
Yes.
Like, I can't, I mean, you sound like a broken record, right? Broadly. You keep coming back to the same thing, but right. this is the battle, right? Mm-hmm. It's the people in the fossil fuel industry are making money and they don't care about this stuff, right? I'm just throwing a side fact. It's like humans have emitted since 1990 as much carbon dioxide as was emitted from the time of James Watt's first steam engine up to 1990, right? So the destruction that we're doing to the planet, we know about, right? We know, and like in the last 30 years, we have put out an enormous amount. So it's not like some long historical thing that happened in 1900. Right. It's us, right? And it's these same people that do not want to change. So the fossil fuel guys get in the way of all this work and try basically to scare people into, mm-hmm.
which of course then goes off into politics. I mean, it's exhausting to even think about, but
yeah. Well, then at some point we have to recognize that, oh, by the way, it's coming. And all we have to do is look at any number of the headlines. What is it? Ian and Fiona. Yeah. I mean, at some point we've been missing some of those hurricanes so far, knock on woods, but storms are getting more and more powerful every time they come through.
I think that's an interesting point. I mean, Puerto Rico is in the Caribbean, obviously, right? It just got slammed by Hurricane Fiona. All the power's out. Okay, say, what a tragedy. There's no electricity in Puerto
Rico.
Was it
Ian or was it Fiona?
Fiona, I'm sorry. Fiona hit it, right? And power goes out. These are American citizens, believe it or not, if you don't know that, they're American right. citizens from a law in 1900. But the power grid after Hurricane Maria, when the former guy went down and threw tissue paper at them, right? Yeah. Hand towels at them, nothing happened, right? And you can go in, there's a political thing there with like Puerto Rico as a commonwealth, essentially a colony, is a cash cow now for Wall Street, where all this in the grid is so privatized there that no solar panels, no wind turbines. They're back to still running diesel oil with rickety lines that go over the mountains to power the whole island. And when the storm hits, the whole island's out. But that's sort of this case in point of the political resistance of the people that are making money off your suffering. Right? Mm-hmm. The guys who made money for the last 5 years rebuilding the grid, they don't care if your power's out for 3 weeks, right? Boom, you know, they'll turn the diesel on when they get some more diesel and give you maybe rebuild, and then you'll get, as opposed to the idea, and this is me talking, it's like the U.S. federal government should take Puerto Rico as a test lab of resilience, distributed generation, and go in there and put solar panels everywhere, wind turbine, make that island completely bulletproof to hurricanes, which you could mm-hmm. do, right? If everyone has solar panels on their roof, then you're less likely to all be out of power.
Right.
And again, it's like, and I know that there's challenges to that, but there's challenges to a lot of stuff. And the idea that everything is subservient to the profit motives of the utility is just a bad place for us to be. So anyway, Fiona, and then of course Fiona, after it visited Puerto Rico, took a bullseye on Halifax, Nova Scotia, which, if you don't know your geography very well, is in Canada, right? And the idea,
it's a long ways away.
The idea that a hurricane would survive and get up to Canada with the intensity that this thing did. That's a little nugget that says, yeah, climate change is real. Mm-hmm. That stuff doesn't happen in a normal world, right?
No, it set a record when it touched land as being the lowest bar readings ever for a storm to touch Canada. And I think there was a NOAA or somebody had shown a chart of just offshore in the center. 63-foot waves. That was a big.
That was a big.
That was a big.
That's enormous. I mean, it's. Yeah, I mean, it's. Again, so then I sound like I'm just whining and ranting all the time. Yeah. But you don't, you know, CNN, MSNBC, the news, they don't like explain this, say, look at the craziness of what's happening, right? It's all kind of muted. Oh, terrible storm hit Canada. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know.
Right. Death of a thousand cuts.
Right. And just to hammer this one more thing, Hurricane Ian is currently progressing up the west coast of Florida.
Right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, who knows what kind of damage. I mean, my own concern is that Ian is going to be clever enough to take a right-hand turn, go back into the Atlantic and come visit Boston, because it's a new world, right?
Just right.
But anyway, Ian is now in the Gulf of Mexico. But what's curious, and this is a climate-related thing, is that it's slowing down.
Yeah.
Right? Just the way Harvey did a few years ago, sat over Houston for 3 days.
Right.
This storm is going to very slowly go up the coast, dump lots and lots of water, do an enormous amount of damage. And that very slowness, my understanding that is related to the sort of upper level winds and the steering currents that have been are less because of climate change. And so, mm-hmm. again, you won't see that anywhere. You'll
right.
barely see it on the Weather Channel. And man.
Yeah. Yeah. And even if it doesn't come up the coast route, which is kind of the normal one, but maybe because of this, it'll take an interior, it'll start dissipating. But at some point in time, it'll gradually curve into New England. And how much rain will we get left? We'll get something, but it'll be days before it gets here and brings some rain for sure. Not that we don't need it. We're still in a drought. We can use it.
We need a long, gentle rain, not a
yes,
not
long,
10
gentle
in
rain,
an
not
hour.
20 to 30 inches over 24 hours. No, no, no.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, the weather is just sort of a interesting sideline, and the weather keeps happening. And yeah, you could spend every show talking about weather events, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I guess the reason I bring these up is that people should listen to weather reports with a different ear. Right. When you say, oh, my goodness, terrible thing happened. One third of Pakistan is flooded. But no one says climate change. Right.
Mm-hmm.
You have to say it to yourself. You have to say,
right.
I wonder if there's right. a connection there. Right.
Yep. Forest fires and droughts out west. I mean, you name it. Pick a spot in the world that
something's
hasn't been
on.
Affected with one extreme or another. And you'll be hard pressed to find one that hasn't been, because it's staggering. So that's why we're trying to make sense of climate. What we can do, and coming back to, okay, we're on the roadmap, we passed some bills, and the work's in front of us.
So can I, so let's come back to Massachusetts. We'll leave the Pakistan and Nova Scotia alone
aside
for a little
for
while.
A moment.
In today's Globe, there was an interesting discussion that I think is climate related. Although no one actually particularly said climate, but it is a climate related thing. And it's climate related because in Massachusetts, transportation and getting around from here to there is roughly one third of the carbon dioxide emissions in our state.
Okay. Correct. Yeah.
Which is a fairly big number. And it's in contrast to other states. Like Massachusetts does not have that much carbon dioxide emission from agricultural stuff. Right? We don't have big combined
lost a lot of farms.
Pig farm. We don't, right? We don't have, I mean, around here, it's most, a third of it is transportation. Well, there's an article in the paper this morning raising the idea that post-COVID, automobile traffic is back big time.
Mm-hmm.
Mass bike yep. jammed up, everything's jammed up, right? Just
right.
the way it was
right.
before. And people have probably heard this thing where if you build another lane, all it does is more people try and take the highway, right?
More
so
cars.
More cars, right? Induced demand by making that. So the solution proposed is not terrible. The solution proposed is to offer what's called congestion pricing. That is to say, the little meter in your car that you use, this smart pass, I guess. Do you have a smart pass in your car?
Mm-hmm. Right? Easy pass?
Easy pass, yeah.
Yes.
Easy pass. Most
yep.
people have easy pass nowadays. And aside from the sort of personal privacy thing of someone knowing where your car is all the time, you could use an Easy Pass to charge people for driving into downtown Boston or driving on Route 93
between 7 and 9 a.m. every day.
Sure.
Right?
Kind of offset some of the hours.
Try and basically, if you have to pay for it, then it's like a toll on the Mass Pike. You have to pay for it, you would avoid it, right? Mm-hmm. You would not be doing it quite so much. That is a classic market-based mechanism for controlling congestion. Ought to be the love child of the poster for conservative politicians, right? This is a way to pay for stuff. My own feeling is that such a thing is a good idea, because the other thing is, you know, Michelle Wu in Boston is closing down streets and they're putting in bike lanes, all kinds mm-hmm. of good stuff happening in Boston, right?
Right.
The issue with congestion pricing, of course, is that it unfairly penalizes people of low income.
Those who have no alternatives to make changes to their daily routes.
Right.
Which then gets into, I'd rather spend more time fixing the MBTA, which has a host of issues from a mass transit side point. And never mind electrifying what they already have in terms of buses and rail, et cetera.
Absolutely.
Start there.
Absolutely.
And then you can use the incentives to foster getting people to the MBTA, but you can't depend upon the MBTA today.
So yes, absolutely right. The banker can spend $4 a day driving down Route 93, no problem. The guy who's going to be a janitor in the same building, $4 a day is a big hit for him, right?
Sure.
So then the article proposes, well, you know, as some sort of rebate for if you're low income, blah, blah, blah. Fine. You know, maybe that's in some ways just, but I agree with you, Steve. Like, the first thing to do is to offer cheap, reliable, frequent mass transit, right, as a way off the, and that opens up a whole enormous discussion about, you know, could you be better on an e-bike, right? Mm-hmm. Do we need to build bike pathways? And the whole debacle of the Orange Line being shut for a month and you know, trains on fire and all this stuff is horrendous. And you say, mm-hmm. you know, if we're going to think about this stuff, if we're going to be proud of our city, you know, why can't we have a nice shiny subway system instead of like rusted stairs and stuff? And mm-hmm. why? Again, because politicians, privatization, yada, yada, yada.
Right.
There's
right.
so much stuff behind it. It's not just incompetence. There's money there that people are So I'm with you. Let's take care of
the other piece, taking it back again to kind of more of a local Franklin and even regional. We have GATRA, which is an on-demand transportation service within Franklin. They've been making some changes, which we still need to work on getting communications out. So that is become, instead of a scheduled route, it's kind of an on-demand service. So point to point in Franklin, it's $1.
Really?
How many people know that?
I did not know that. I mean, I could call up and within some sort of like an Uber thing where they would come and get you and
yeah,
drop
and that's
you off.
Where it's sort of like an Uber thing. It's not as demand dependent as mm-hmm. an Uber thing because there's less shuttle buses to
right.
do that.
Right.
But the concept is the same, and it's an issue at least through the senior center because most of them you do have an 800 number to call. Or an app. And obviously a lot of the seniors don't have the smartphones to use the app. Right. So there's that accessibility, never mind accessibility to transportation. And then, at least from what I've been hearing, you can call and schedule an appointment to get you to the doctor's on time. But then when you get to the doctor, it may be, you know, another 2 hours or whatever to get you back. So there's less reliability there. So to a transportation issue, let's use some of that. Because we did have streetcars way back in the day, right? And those, obviously, back in the day were like a nickel or 10 cents to go from Franklin to Rentham and whatever. Something like that, since it's regional transportation, or the state's already funding the regional transportation, we need to come up with some other ways that can allow within Franklin, because especially from an accessibility standpoint, even a bike lane. Okay, well, a senior wouldn't necessarily ride a bike unless they've got a three-wheeled kind of supportable, you know, with the baskets and stuff. But they may not have the energy in order to do that as well. So
I foresee the electric rickshaw pedaling up and down King Street. Right?
Yeah. But, Yeah. That'd until we get to the on-demand and self-driving electric vehicles, which may be in our lifetime. Who knows? We do need something between now and then. So
it'd be a fascinating interview to talk to someone from GATRA, because I guess I had not appreciated that they were at least offering that service, right?
And
but the just to stay with Franklin for a minute, I know there are efforts to think about, you know, honest to God bike lanes on some of the major intersections and major streets, but
sure,
it wouldn't take too much here to have bike lanes on some of the major streets that would then feed into neighborhoods, and you could safely get from one place to another.
Yeah. And so it's, and bringing up the neighborhoods. So in the neighborhoods when we grew up, and yes, we're aging ourselves, but in most of the neighborhoods when we were growing up as kids, so for me in the 50s and 60s, there was a neighborhood store. Whether it was a meat market or a bread store, there were neighborhood stores. Because of the way we're zoned today, that doesn't exist. So we do have an opportunity here in Franklin as part of that Franklin for All. They're looking at zoning. As an example, in the Charles River area, consider, you know, a couple of houses, instead of getting sold, some developer buys them and puts in, whether it's a beauty salon, a pizza parlor, some kind of service and food-oriented thing. Then people could walk to that, as opposed to getting into the car and having to go to one of the stores that are in the major malls at either end of it, and then replicate. We already have some of that in kind of the older neighborhoods along Lincoln Street with the Daisy Market, along, you know, Pond Street, near the, the Beach Street intersection. There's a market off to the side. Some of the older neighborhoods still have those neighborhood markets. But the newer ones, because they were zoned single zoning, prohibited.
I mean, you need, it seems to me that what you need is have to have a business model where you can prohibit parking. There's no, I mean, nobody wants a bunch of parking and trash next to their house, right?
There are two sides of the coin, absolutely. And yes.
But
yes.
I mean, if you could find a way, and it comes back to you know, the capitalism, it talks about efficiency, right? The cheapest price and whatnot. It's like, you can't, I mean, you're paying for, I don't want to say this, you're paying for all that low price by having people that drive up and trash around and lights on all night, right? Whereas if you're willing to somehow pay more, I know that sounds like a privilege kind of thing, but I mean, you know, you
pay an appropriate premium, say
an appropriate premium, right, to have a shop where you could walk to, pick stuff up, and there's not a blight on the neighborhood, right? It's not a 7-Eleven.
So again, it may have cost you 25 cents to walk to pay more for that, but then you've saved money on the gas going to the bigger store,
and your quality of life is better, right? I mean, and so what I'm pitching is a different way to think about how these things run. Right, it's not all about cost convenience, right? It's about how do you live your life, you know, what sort of neighborhood do you want to live in? And those are enormous questions, right? Which I'm not pretending I have an answer to, but you start thinking about what because I've thought, I've said I should start a service not unlike this Peapod thing out of the, some of the supermarkets where they deliver food,
right?
But if you had an electric rickshaw bike where you pedal through a neighborhood and you had, you know, fresh fruit, some milk, some butter, you could you would sell it to people as you drive around,
kind that of a portable like really farmer's market.
The business model is kind of kooky, and I'm not saying it's real that you could actually do it, but I mean, that's how cities worked long time ago. And again, not to go too far down this path, but I mean, the other question is density, right? All of those sort of business models are driven by having more people in smaller areas.
Sure.
And not everyone wants their quarter acre of heaven, right? These are things that have to be discussed, right? You want to like at least broach the topic and say, what do you think?
And that's where at least the message is now. If you want to do something, you can on multiple fronts. Clearly on the climate direct action side, on the electricity, make sure you're part of the municipal aggregation. And even in the zoning piece, you sound like, well, zoning is hard. Well, zoning can have an impact in terms of our quality of life. Right. So consider participating in those discussions, because it's a process. It will take time. The discussions are ongoing and they haven't been resolved yet. So there's still an opportunity.
So. And that just Steve, you know more than I about this, but remind me, the part of that discussion revolves around a very real reasonable thing that says there should be housing in proximity to transit. Mass transit, right? And while we just complained about how MBTA doesn't work, right? So mm-hmm. MBTA has to work. I mean, yep. all this stuff has to happen together, right? Yep. But still in all, that's a vision, right? Where you have good housing close to some sort of convenient transportation and facilities that don't require you to jump in your car and drive 2 miles to get to a big parking lot,
right?
And yep. those visions are entertaining. It. What I find is that since there's an actual discussion happening in Franklin, it does give sort of grounding to the whole thing, right? It sort of brings it into a very realistic place where you say, gee, you know, what does that mean for us? What mm-hmm. could we do?
Right.
And that's a good discussion to be having.
Absolutely. You know, and then I'll put it in a plug this weekend coming up. And assuming this will be out before then, it usually is. Harvest Festival, downtown Franklin. Walk Main Street. Look at the buildings. Those buildings, if heaven forbid, but if a fire happened to one of them, you could not rebuild that today with the existing zoning. It's really? Prohibited. So what do we want to do? If we want the downtown we have, what do we have to do to change those zoning so we could redo something that would still kind of look and feel like the downtown? And oh, by the way, give us maybe some more density and we can walk to the train station. And yes, the state still needs to fix the MBTA, but at least things would start coming together and we can work on what we can do. And to that extent, being part of the discussions, we can do that locally, which is one of the reasons why we're having this conversation, so that we can get the ideas on this and then share it out, and hopefully people, hey, did you listen to Ted and Steve?
It's like the first time you hear something, it sounds kooky, right? It's craziness, but then it slowly, they talk about normalizing stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Just having the discussion is not socialism, it's not insanity, it's not theft of your wages, right? Right. It's a realistic discussion about what does it mean to be in community? What does it mean for us all to live together? What does it mean for us to have, well, your planet is maybe too big, but a local area where there's still trees, right, mm-hmm. that people can walk to, that we can all enjoy in common.
Sure.
Great discussion.
The world clearly is not perfect. And with a slight plug into another radio show called Toward a More Perfect Union, clearly we're in a work in progress. And on the climate front and on the zoning front, we've got things we can do as well. So as we get towards that ideal, and will we reach it in our lifetime? Hopefully for our kids' lifetime or grandkids' lifetime, they'll be better off.
Yeah. I mean, the...
Well, we've just spent a bunch of time on a Tuesday, and hopefully, I'm a little bit got more sense around climate, so I thank you for that. Hopefully, the listeners will have as well. So thank you for taking time today to share your insights and expertise and links and knowledge.
My pleasure.
And passion.
Now, these are great discussions And dear listener, you probably they're somewhat open-ended, not clear where they're always going to go. But I think that raising these more speculative kinds of topics eventually begin to crystallize into some kind of ideas about what's possible, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So if you are a new listener and struggled and are still listening, thank you for doing so. And if you struggled, well, I think you'll learn that you just kind of fasten the seatbelts and go for the ride with us and come back next time, because we've got a few more to do, and we'll explore some additional topics, because as we've discussed, the roadmap will take some time to work, and the work is ahead of us. And one final reminder, we do this because Franklin matters.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tintype Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.
So there you have it. Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.